The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I don't think there's any theological or biblical promise that we've got that gives us the hope that the Presbyterians will never die out. I mean, the church can't die out, but the Presbyterians certainly can. On the other hand, I've given you a topic called Presbyterians in the Future, and what I mean by that is I think that the best way to look at this would be to look and see what the future holds for the next 20 to 40 years, and then say, how should Presbyterians be in the future to respond to that? You see, it's a lot easier to judge the history of the world in the next 40 years than to judge history of Presbyterians for the next 40 years. Much easier. And what we need to do, therefore, is not talk about what Presbyterians will be in the next 20 to 40 years, but what Presbyterians should be. I think that's really better. We could sit around if you want to and say, we'll do that, but we'll never do that. And so, in the end, we may actually be able to talk about the future of American Presbyterianism, too. I need to be rather brief, and so I want to simply say that I'm going to look at this under four headings. Waves, tides, rocks, and seawalls. By waves, I mean I'd like to take a look and see what the emerging social, economic, political, and cultural trends are that are emerging now that are probably going to shape the world and give us an idea what the world's going to look like the next 20 to 40 years. Then I'd like to talk briefly, very briefly, about the tides. You see, a wave is just a manifestation of a tide. Waves are little things on top of the big things, which are tides. And even though a lot of the futurologists are talking about the economic and social trends, we can go to them and find out what things are going to happen in the next 20 or 40 years. Underneath the waves are tides. That is, changes in worldview, changes in philosophy, changes in the ways we look at God and the way we look at the universe. And very briefly, I like to touch on that, because you can't understand waves unless you understand the currents underneath. Then we'd like to talk about rocks. And what I mean by rocks is the problems that are looming up ahead of us. You know, waves are no trouble unless you get caught between one and a rock. And I think that the waves that we're going to be talking about, the waves of the future, are pushing us real quickly against five rocks that are going to kill us. I'm talking about us, meaning society, human society. And then lastly, we can say, what can the church do to, defensively, you one thing you do about encroaching water is build a seawall. Offensively, you can actually go out and try to reclaim some land, and we can talk about that. So you can say, I can't do that in 50 minutes too well. But let me simply say that I'd like to start talking about the waves real briefly. The one thing that you have to recognize is that everyone historians of the world would say there's really only been two major social cultural shifts. We had an agricultural-based society up until, historians would know better than me, I'm not a historian, to say when we shifted over to an industrial-based society. The thing that you have to keep in mind here, I need to have you take away, is that virtually everyone, no matter what their value sets, no matter what their backgrounds or theological mindsets, everyone who's really looking at where we're going, is saying we're about to get into a third, and it's only the third major cultural social shift. We're moving out of the industrial age, and we're not sure what we're moving into, but the fact is that we're moving into this third period, and we're going to have to, from here on, this morning, call it the post-industrial age. We'll call it the technological age. We don't know what it is, but we're talking about not just an extension of what you've known. We can't look at the last 50 years and say, well, it'll be like that. You know, my father, my great-grandfather came up in a horse and buggy, and now we're moving from horse and buggy to car to rocket ships, and you can't think like that. You have to recognize that what we've got here is we're moving into a qualitatively different world, and to help you understand that, let's talk about industrialization. Let's look at the first shift. The shift from agricultural to industrialization in the 18th century, whenever that happened at different times in different places, and it's still happening in some parts of the world now. But if you want us to talk about the shift, maybe we can talk about three characteristics of industrialization. The one characteristic would be, what I have down here, standardization. Because of mass production, you have standardization. You have row homes. You have uniform weights and measures, uniform time frames. Public education was part of that. There was a need to go to being standardized, because instead of having little businesses with a few people working, you had big businesses with a lot of people working for it. That's a second characteristic of industrialization, is centralization. There was no such thing as a big corporation before, you know, industrialization, but big corporations, big government, big business, and so on. Centralization, bureaucracy, is a fruit of industrialization. And the third mark of industrialization is specialization. You know, in the agricultural situation, the family consumed what it made. You know, you wore what you made. You ate what you made. See, you're a jack of everything. But now, of course, we in other words, you didn't have consumers. A consumer is someone who takes something and consumes something that they didn't make. And what you've got in industrial society is specialization. Everybody does one thing, you produce one product, and then you consume products from all sorts of other people. The fact is that we are moving out of that era. We're moving out of the industrialization era. John Nesbitt, who wrote Megatrends, oversimplifies, and he says, you can summarize the whole history of the United States in three words: farmer, laborer, clerk. So that's it. That's all there is to it. Now, look, here's what he can say. Before industrialization, 70-80% of the people in this country were farmers. At the turn of the century, 1900, 33% of Americans were farmers. And in the early parts of the 20th century, 40, 50, even 60% of all the people in this country worked in manufacturing jobs. Today, because of this shift happening, only 12% of the people in this country work in manufacturing jobs. Only 12% are laborers. And what you've got now is, as of today, 65% of all the people who've got jobs in this country have jobs in the information industry. Now, what an information industry means is this: everybody needs information to do their job, but the difference is that a professional job or a clerical job is that in that sort of job, the creation, processing, and distribution of information is the job. Today, and it's rapidly growing, 65% of everybody who's working is in information. And of course, the professional sector is growing like rapidly, and that's part of the information industry. So what's happening is we're moving from farmers. You see, today, 3% of all the laborers today are farmers, only 3, and that's going down very fast. You have no idea how fast it's going down. From 1977 to 1980 alone, in New York City area, 40,000 industrial jobs, 40,000 manufacturing jobs were lost forever, for good. And the reason for that is the microprocessor. The microprocessor is the piece of technology that in the history of the world, there's never been one that has greater applicability. Those few 12%, the 12% of the manufacturing jobs that we've got now, remember we said it's down from 40, 50, 60 to 12%, in the next 15 years, 75% of them will be eliminated by what? By high technology. 75% of them. In other words, we're not going to have many farmers. We will have some laborers, just like we have to have some farmers, but not many. And what's happening is the information industry, high technology, is taking over. Now, when high technology takes over, you've got the reversal of those three. If you take a look here, let's see. Yeah. You have the reversal of those three industrialization traits. First of all, moderate technology, industrialization, brings standardization, but high technology brings diversification. So high technology is getting rid of standardization, and we're going to a customized society. For example, 20 years ago, if a company had 40,000 workers, the only way in which they could keep them straight, keep their files straight, keep their contracts straight, is to treat them all as a unit, right? And so you had to have union negotiations. You had to have standardization. But today, with computers, every single employee not only can have his own job, but every employee can have his own working hours. They can work at home. They can work anytime they want, quite frankly. It's the end of mass production. For example, high-tech industry does not need long runs. Do you understand that? In industrialization, you need long runs. In other words, if you order 100 shirts, that's going to be less expensive than 10 shirts, right? Not anymore. For example, Today, you've got a laser machine that cuts shirts and makes shirts. I mean, it's not being in use yet, but it will be within 5 years. That laser beam machine can cut a shirt faster than all the mass production technology they ever had before. And a laser beam cuts shirts one at a time. And therefore, it will be just as economical to do a run of one kind of shirt as it will be to do a run of 1,000 shirts. Even McDonald's is stopping. By the way, even McDonald's has started to say, we've got to start stopping building the same kind of unit everywhere. I don't know if you've noticed that. But the fact is that we're going into a post-standardization mentality. I'll tell you another part of post-standardization is the ethnicizing of America. It was considered back in the industrial age that when you came to America, you needed to lose your language. Who was this? When was that law that said it was illegal to study another language before?
In the 20s.
You know, that's that. Now that is an industrialized society. That definitely is mass production. We've got to have workers here, you know. We've got to be able to get them in there, and they've got to work on the assembly line. Not true. You now have what Andrew Greeley calls the rise of the unmeltable ethnics, that people will come to this country and be able to keep their cultural identity for much, much longer than they ever did before. Much longer. And that's because we're becoming a society in which people are able to have things their way. We'll get back to that. Now, specialization, that's leaving. Why? The economists are saying this is very interesting. And I know this may be news to you, but it won't be news to you in 2 or 3 years. Because of high technology, the average worker will expect to completely change his career 5 or 6 times. In other words, completely change what he does. So the idea of going to college, for example, and just studying engineering is definitely going to be a dead end. So what you're going to need instead of specialization in the future is a general liberal arts education. That's the most important. There's hope for you guys, the history. Wow. You know, your PhD in history, you know, what do? Teach a seminary? Who knows, you know? Drive a bus, right? But there's hope for liberal arts people, and that is, there's two things you're going to need in order to come out of college and be ready for the future. You need to know the English language. You need to be able to know how to read, be articulate, grasp things. And the second thing is you need to know computers. If you know those two things, fine. The point is, there's going to be a move away from specialization to generalization. For example, Alvin Toffler talks about the rise of the prosumer, not the consumer. A prosumer is somebody who consumes what he makes. In an industrial society, you make one thing at your job, and then you consume what everybody else makes. Haven't you noticed, though, there is a massive move away from expertise to do it yourself? Homeschooling, home medical care, you can decide if you're pregnant at home. Counseling and support groups, we're getting away from the expertise, you see. Build your own TV sets, build your own cars, do your own garden. The fact is there is a movement away, and high tech makes that possible, you see. For example, and this is 5 years from now. 5 years from now, you're going to be able to have an electronically computerized smart sewing machine. You'll be able to buy a cassette to put in there and make your own shirts. 5, 10 years from now. For example, within 2 years, you'll be able, those of you who do a lot of traveling, you'll be able to make your own airplane reservations through your home computer. Stick the phone on there, you'll be able to make your own reservation. We're moving away from specialization. We're moving away from that completely we're going to go even further. We're moving away from analysis. In every area, just about every field of endeavor, everybody's yelling about what's called interdisciplinary studies and holism. Everywhere you look, holism, synthesis, interdisciplinary studies, bring it all together. Even science, this is kind of a scary thing. Science has always been positivistic. Science's base has always been positivistic analyze. And the things that scientists are saying today are scary, and we'll get back to that later, because it shows an underlying worldview shift. They were better when they were just plain humanists. For example, here's what one Stanford lecturer, Willis Harmon, announced to a group, psychic quote, and he's a scientist type. Psychic research and consciousness research indicate that a number of the implicit premises underlying modern positivistic science are being challenged by the most recent findings of science itself. And then he goes on and states that surveys show that there's a greater interest in spiritual and psychic matters among the better educated. And then he says this: the growing suspicion is that traditional religion and conventional positivistic science are both partial and flawed, due to us to be superseded by a more unified view of reality. And then he says, that's the reason why we need to start studying things like remote viewing, precognition, psychokinesis, transcendental meditation, altered states of consciousness, biofeedback training, and other things. Now, what they're doing is they're saying, we scientists have not been looking at the supernatural world, at the immaterial world. We've got to start looking at things holistically. So there's a move away from specialism. Now, there's some horrible things about that I'll get back to. But you see, the movement away from generalization and analysis to synthesis and all the emphasis on holism. Thirdly, and this is just about, this is the most important maybe, it's a complete move away from centralization, which was the mark of an industrialized society. You can see it at the most superficial level. You can see it in the way chain stores are struggling and TV networks are struggling. TV networks are struggling, and what we're going to do is we have more independent stations than ever, more local stations than ever, and cable. Chain stores are finding that they're having a great deal of trouble maintaining the chain stores where every chain store outlet is the same, and you're moving away from big department stores to little boutiques and shopping malls, which recreate the old Village Green with their little shops and so on. But you can see it in that area, but there's a lot of other areas you can see it in. For example, in the area of politics, the fact is that at the top, there's very little, if any, growing influence at the federal government level, and it's at the local level and the grassroots level that almost all the politics go on now. For example, there are no longer two political parties. Somebody's estimated in America there's at least 512. And what you've got is you have lobbyists, you have special interest groups, and they, whoever is yelling the loudest, and there's dozens and dozens of them, get the laws passed. Don't you remember when it used to be possible to build a freeway? Why isn't it possible to do that anymore? It's impossible. You know, it used to be possible to build a prison or a trash to steam plant. Why not? Because why? Because local communities have learned how to organize. The taxpayer revolt is part of this. Grassroots, for example, initiatives and state referenda, things like that, there's been a 500, 600, 700% increase in those things over the last 5 years, 10 years. And that's why a lot of the futurologists are saying nation states are cracking up. You know, you've got independence movements in Quebec, in Ireland, Corsica, Armenia, all these places are saying, give us more home rule. And this is it's a worldwide trend. And that is that the nation state at the top is not the place where politics is going on. Let me go on and say, let's see, there's an entrepreneurial explosion. Talk about decentralization. In the last 10 years, 80%, no, two-thirds of all the new jobs created in the last 10 years were generated by businesses employing 20 people or less. In the same period of time, the 1,000 largest companies in this country showed virtually no growth. And the reason for that is there's a movement away from working for big corporations, and it's the self-employed person and the small businessman is growing. It's hard to believe when you see what self-employment Social Security tax is, but it's still growing. And the movement is away from the old hierarchical approach. For example, people in this country are starting to look at Japan and saying, what are they doing right? And they're starting to incorporate that philosophy of management over here. For example, that philosophy of management goes like this, that employees participate in discussion as equals with their superiors. There's a stress on long-term employment, consensus decision-making, non-specific career paths. For example, when a Japanese man gets hired by a corporation, they're going to keep him. They may change his job around, and he may not increase in his money and in his income quite as quick, but they're committed to him, and he's committed to them forever, see? There's a consensus. The way decisions are made is not just by a couple of guys at the top, but employees have a great deal of consensus, and America's moving in that direction. It's a decentralized model for management. Another institution feeling the effects of decentralization is the family. Now, I want to say something kind of interesting about that. In general, it's fair to say, though people differ, that industrialization whittled the family down. Now, see, the agricultural family was bigger than the industrial family, right? Sure. Industrial family is father, mother, and the kids. The agricultural family tended to be the extended family more. Even if they weren't under the same roof, they were in the same neighborhood. That's not as true now. But the technological age is whittling it down further. So the basic social unit of agriculture was the extended family. The basic social unit of industrialization was the nuclear family. But the basic social unit of technological age is what?
The
the individual. That's right. For example, even in 1960, 43% of all households consisted of a working husband and a wife at home and kids. Today, 7% of all households are a working father and a wife at home with kids. For example, 25% of all households today consist of one person. And in 55, it was 10%. And the most interesting thing is this. There's a tendency for evangelicals to say, gay rights, pornography, things like that are just whittling down the family. That's not true. It's the computer. I believe that. Alvin Toffler, he's cynical about this, but he's right. He says, if you want to get the nuclear family back in society, he says, number one, he says, subsidize manufacturing and block the rise of service industry because white-collar professional technical workers have always been less family-oriented, more intellectually and psychologically mobile than blue-collar workers. Secondly, he says, divorce rates have always risen along with the rise in service occupations. Then he says, make sure you ban the increasingly demassified media. Demassified means instead of a network and a major daily, you've got dozens and dozens of cable networks now, cable stations and dozens of special interest newspapers and magazines and so on. He says, ban that because nuclear families work best when there's a national consensus on information values, not a society based on high diversity. He's right. And then he says, cut the standard of living of the entire society to the pre-55 levels, since affluence makes it possible for single and divorced people and unattached people to make it economically. And what he's saying is, it really goes deeper than gay rights and pornography and things like that. The fact is, moving away from industrialization is putting tremendous stress on the family so that we're becoming radically individualized. Radically individualized. As a consequence of this, not only are we finding that the family is being broken up, but the median age is rising because the birth rate's going down. So we're getting to be older. And most of you heard that when I turn 65, 21% of everybody in this country will be over 65. Today, it's about 11 or 12%, so you can see what a huge difference it's going to be. Another consequence of decentralization is that we don't have leaders. Those of you who are my age and went to a Northeastern school in the late 60s know what happened. We were all idealistic and everybody had values and we all sold out. If you want to see one film that tells you about the future, you need to see The Big Chill. If you've never seen that, it's gross in a lot of ways, of course, but you need to see that, partly because you have a picture of my generation, and that is, it's a leaderless generation. The baby boomers turned 40. Did you see that as a cover article in Time magazine? It says one of the main things that's weird about this generation doesn't have leaders, and the reason for that is because we had values, and they were, in many cases, they were Christian values as a generation, but because there wasn't a Christian base for them, they got out in the world, and they all sold out, and they know it. And therefore, they're deeply cynical about themselves. And nobody even wants to say, follow me, I know where I'm going. It's just not there. For example, Robert Nisbet, who wrote The History of the Idea of Progress, had a really remarkable thing to say about the fact that there's really no reigning intellectual class anymore. There's no leading philosophers anymore. There's no leading anybody. And he says this. For example, he takes one area to show what's happening in the modern age. He says, look at writers. He says, our writers today are divided unequally between the so-called serious group, whose fame lies for the most part in coteries, I'm saying that right, isn't it? And the popular writers whose shoddy work sells in the millions of copies. He says, there isn't a Dickens today. There's no culture hero. There's nobody anymore who's a great writer everybody knows and who's popular. It's impossible in the modern age. The reason for this condition, the debasement of literature, the estrangement of writer and public, is our lack of true culture. The disappearance of the sacred always is the heart of any genuine culture. I'll get back to that too in a second. The growth in litigation. Why do you think there's all the incredible growth in litigation and in suing people and so on? One of it's because of decentralization. We don't have any interest in big government, big business. We want to bring the big guy down. We're moving away. We're decentralized and radically individualized. One other thing I should say, though, I should say one thing before leaving this, the fact that we're decentralizing. In spite of the fact that you see nation states and corporations and everybody in this country losing power and there's this individualism, At a higher level, there is a growth, and that's in the transnational corporation. I'll say something about this in a second. Well, I'll say something about it right now, because the seconds are going, and I'll probably never get back to it. A transnational corporation is a corporation that has divisions in more than one country. So, for example, a corporation might do research in one country, have a manufacturing division in another country, they manufacture parts, assemble them in a third country at a factory, sell them in a fourth country, and then save its savings in a fifth. Now, right now, there's 2,000 companies, that transnational companies, that have affiliates in six or more countries. And there's 8,000 that operate in at least two. Now, the fact is there's nobody who can control those groups. They've grown incredibly in power. They don't answer to anybody. For example, when America says, we're going to have an embargo, we're not going to buy anything from that country, a transnational corporation says, well, we're not an American company. And so they go over the embargo. And what you've got is these transnational corporations are becoming countries. For example, Exxon's got a bigger tanker fleet than anybody in the world, I believe. You know, they've got more ships than any navy. There's a number of corporations that have got their own... A number of corporations have their own intelligence corps that rivals the CIA and the KGB, and they've got their own diplomatic corps. And so they're becoming... So there's a sense in which it's invisible that even as decentralization down here, there's an amassing of power at a top level that actually people don't even see. Now, that's the waves. Now, I don't know. I'm just trying to say here. Let me say something really quick. If you turn over to page two, I'm going to say something very quick. Boy, too quick. Let me pull out things here. Oh, you see, I said waves are, we're talking about, I'm giving you statistics. I'm showing you economic trends, social trends, cultural trends. But underneath them are consciousness trends. Now, Presbyterian evangelicals like to call these things worldviews. That's because we think in terms of the history of philosophy. I guess I call it a worldview too. And I would like to point out the fact that there's an emerging worldview that's underlying all of these trends. Now there's two major currents going into this worldview. Using my image of tides, right? The idea that this is waves and now these are tides. The two major currents are secularization and pluralization. Secularization, how do you define secularization? Best way to define that is to say secularization is a dogma that says you can keep your religion out in the private world, but you can't bring it into the public world. And the public world is the central sectors of politics, education, business, science and technology, and places like that. I'm going to read from Peter Berger, who is a sociologist, and he gives you the best definition of secularization there is. Okay? Stop thinking about secular humanism for a second. Just think about the essence of it. And he says, the modern consciousness, the modern mindset, is the insistence that common everyday life is the only reality. Listen, this is a very distinctive and a very new development in history. You've got to understand that. Before modern times, all worldviews saw ordinary life as one room, an antechamber in a vaster, more real world full of divine supernatural forces. This larger world could bring the ordinary life into question and judge it. It also gave meaning to the ordinary life. At the same time, it gave the everyday world a cosmic frame of reference. The charters of every one of our institutions, government, church, every institution, got its guidelines for our actions derived from the larger world. And then he says, quote, it is precisely this kind of legitimation, in other words, The everyday world was legitimized by the larger world. See, no matter what your religion or what your worldview was, everybody had that as a basic framework. It says it's the loss of this kind of legitimation. This kind of legitimation has lost credibility in recent history. The loss is the heart of what we call secularization. The reality of ordinary life is increasingly positive as the only reality, or if you will, the common sense world becomes a world without windows. And Berger's the one. If you've ever heard that before, it's Peter Berger came up with that. And that's what a secular mindset is. We have a world without windows. The everyday life, there's nothing to look, there's nothing more than that. Now, secularization actually says that in everyday life, religion has got no relevance because there's no absolute truths that have to do with the way in which we do business and education and so on. But there is a place for religion, and that is in the private world. And one of the key things about secularization is that in the private world, that's the spot where you can be personal, That's a spot where you can find meaning in life. That's a spot where if you want to get into religion that makes you feel better, that's the place to go. And so another characteristic of this modern consciousness is that the private life of leisure and relationships is the spot where meaning and personal identity is found. In the Christian era, in the generally Christian era, you lived in order to work. You found your meaning in work, in accomplishing something. Today, you work in order to live. That's a complete change. The modern consciousness says, you work, you get out there in the modern world and you work. And you sublimate personal interests and you sublimate religious desires because they have no place in the workplace. You get in there and you work so you can make bucks, so you can get out and really live. And that's the reason why there's been an explosion in the leisure industry, an explosion in the entertainment industry, and it's going to continue. Because people find their meaning in the private world, whereas it used to be people found their meaning in life in the public world, whether they were Christians or not, you see. And therefore, that's a major shift, very, very, very important to understand. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is pluralization for a second. Pluralization comes from secularization in this sense. We've already said secularization demands that you keep the public life and your private world apart. What you do in your private world is fine, but you do not bring that into the public sector because there we are objective. That's the end of technology. Is there any way to tell whether or not that still works?
Yes, I
know. We'll see. See, that's really not high tech. Because that's the human factor. Still working? It's still ticking. John Cameron Keller. Okay. Pluralization. It comes from secularization because in the olden days, before modern times, you had the same basic values that brought integration to your public and your private world. We already said that. We said how I worked and how I played and how I spent time with my family, there was an overarching values that judged all of them and sort of tied them together. But in our modern world, we have to completely divide ourselves. And again, I'm going to rely on Peter Berger, and he gives a remarkable statement of what happens to the modern man. He says this, in pre-modern societies, people lived in a world that was coherent. But because of the plurality of social worlds in modern society, the structures of each particular world are experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Now listen carefully, I'll try to explain this then. Consequently, the institutional order undergoes a certain loss of reality. And the individual experiences himself is more real than any of his social worlds. Therefore, the individual seeks to find his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside of himself. Now, let me explain that. That, to me, as a pastor, this is very practical stuff, helps me understand the modern consciousness, which is underlying all these waves. Berger is saying because there isn't an overarching value structure that gives meaning to every part of your life. You move from section of your life to section of your life and you have to completely change gears. When you're in your private life, it can be one way, but in your public life, you can't bring that in another way. And he says, what ends up happening is the individual begins to find more, that he is more real than any of his social worlds because every world has a role to be played. He's like an actor. And over here, he has to act like this, and over here, he has to act like this. And as a result of this, Berger says, modern man is unusually conversion prone, highly conversion prone, because he can change roles very quickly, but it's almost impossible to get him to commit. He's not commitment prone. For example, what is the midlife crisis? The midlife crisis is a modern malady. We just didn't have, can you imagine 1920s a midlife crisis? Can you even imagine 1940s a midlife crisis? Let me tell you, the midlife crisis comes because modern man is told that he is more real than any of his social worlds, and because we are told that in our private life we've got to have choices, lots and lots of choices, we've got to do a lot of things because that's where we're going to find meaning in life, right? And so we've got to have multiple choices. That's why MasterCard is now after us, because he knows that this is ringing a bell. It says MasterCard. The reason I have MasterCard is because of what? It gives me more choices, personal choice. Midlife crisis comes because a person is able to live in a certain life all of his life and finally decide, I don't think this is fulfilling me anymore, and he just completely changes roles. He dumps his wife, he dumps his career, he goes buys a big red sports car, and he has to do that in order to find meaning in life. Are you following this at all? The church growth people need to really be aware of the fact that modern man is extremely conversion prone. He's got no problem in picking up a new social world for a while and then dropping it for a while, because he is more real than any of these rules. That's the reason why we used to have a concept of honor. We don't anymore. We only have a concept of dignity. Big difference. Honor was something you had by virtue of your position in life. For example, there was such a thing as chivalry, because a woman, you treated a woman, she had a certain honor as a woman. She's not just an amorphous something, she's a woman, you're a man. Offices in the church, offices in society, status in society, there was a certain kind of honor that you gave to people by virtue of who they were in that role. Today, you don't have that. Today you've got dignity, and dignity says that no matter who you are, we've got certain rights, and it's a way of saying that an individual is free from all rules. Put it like this, the historic concept of honor implied that human identity was essentially linked to institutional roles. I think that's biblical. For example, your honor depended on, your honor, let's see, and how it was to be carried was inseparably linked with your gender, your station in life, role in the family, church, or state, whether you're a father, a mother, a child, and so on. On the other hand, the modern concept of dignity is that our identity is totally independent of our relationship to family, church, state, or any institution at all. And that's the reason why the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations, talks about dignity and never about honor. Because honor is a pre-modern, and it's got its roots in Christianity, it's a pre-modern view of things, and dignity is a modern view of things. Now, that's the reason why there's so many divorces, because people can just pick up a role and then get rid of a role. That's the reason that the average worker can change careers so fast. Or is it, you know, it's also, we have to keep in mind the fact that modern man is conversion prone, but not commitment prone at all. That's why it's very, very easy to grow a church if you know how to pull the right strings. As Martin Marty once said, it's very easy to grow a clientele. It's actually not very easy to grow a church. Now, let me just finish the thing on the tithes. The thing you have to recognize is, I'm going to have to be mighty brief here. The thing you have to recognize is, Presbyterians and Evangelicals have a tendency to analyze culture by looking at the history of ideas. So, for example, we say, is this person a secularist or not? And we said, well, what is his view of God, what is his view of man, and so on. You have to realize, Oz Guinness wrote a book called The Gravedigger File, which is a pretty helpful book, and he says that we also have to use the sociology of knowledge and cultural anthropology to understand modern man, not just the history of ideas, because the average man in the street has never heard of Immanuel Kant. So how does Immanuel Kant, some of you who know something about history of philosophy are starting to think, isn't this interesting? Modern man says in the public sector, we have nothing to do with finding your true self, has nothing to do with metaphysical values, but in the private sector, you know, the noumenal realm, that's where we can talk about these things. Ah, that means modern society is Kantian. Well, the point is this. What Austin S. is trying to say is there never have been many secularists. Secularists are people with a full-blown understanding of, they have a full-blown intellectual way of looking at life, they understand philosophy. And they've always been small, and they always will be. And therefore, they always have been a kind of minor presence in society. But what's happened today is we've got carriers that take secularism and turn it into secularization. That is, they've got carriers that can convert the man in the street to being to acting secular, even though intellectually, when you ask them, do you believe in God? Yes. Do you believe in heaven and hell? Yes. They've got the intellectual Christian framework, but they've been infected with the worldview of secularism through a process called secularization. Oz Guinness, I think, says this, secularization is not a philosophy, it is a process. Unlike a philosophy, this mentality is not something people think about or choose. Rather, it rubs off. It comes as part and parcel of objective institutional changes which have actually occurred through modernization and can't be avoided or wished away. When secularism stuck to largely intellectual arguments, it appealed only to a tiny minority. When it caught the imagination of the masses through other means, people were converted without any serious argument or extensive reading. In other words, secularism is a small group of people, but through technology, through the media, and through bureaucracy, in other words, through working in a bureaucracy, through working in technology, you become secularized, even though you're not a secularist. And that's what Oz Guinness is saying. And therefore, we have to be careful in simply looking at a history of ideas and saying, is modern man a humanist? Is modern man an existentialist? Is modern man a hedonist? Instead of looking for full-blown worldviews, you've got to realize that through the carriers, in America today, there is a modern working worldview that is not something that people have thought through. And it's not something that people have been argued into. And in fact, it's not even consistent. And let me tell you what that is. When I was in college, there were two worldviews that were competing. There was what Theodore Roszak called consciousness number one. And it's what we as kids called the establishment. And what it was a plain old, it was a positivistic, humanistic way of looking at life. And that is, there is a God, there's a personal God. There are some basic laws of being good. Our main role in life is to make the world a better place to live, and you've got to have hard work, and you've got to be moral because it's good for the kids. And you know, that's how my parents were. You know, I'm not saying my particular parents weren't Christians, but I'm saying that my parents' generation were like that. They're moral. They had, they were humanists, and that's consciousness number one. Then my generation came along. The counterculture came along with a very, very clearly existentialist or Eastern worldview, and that said, remember, tune in, drop out. Remember? Yeah, anybody remember that? In other words, don't you dare take a business course and make money. Live out in the country. Peace, love, and groovy vibes. You know, let's love one another and let's make the world a better place, but not in the same way that my parents are trying to do, not through technology. We hate technology. We hate business. We hate corporations. That stuff is a carrier of something bad that we don't like. And those were two very distinct worldviews, and they were kind of put together. What's happened is, through technology and bureaucracy and the media, these two worldviews have come together into what I would call a modern man. You know who the modern man is? First of all, I need to find my sheet. Stupid with it. The modern man is, there he is. The yuppie. Let me explain who the yuppie is. Okay. Yuppies are upscale. In their public life, these are people who are my age. In their public life, these people who used to burn down the Ronzi building, and you could read about them in the Baby Boomers Turned 40 Time magazine spread just last month. These are the people who burned down the Ronzi building. These are people who copulated in the streets, and now what they're doing is they're selling real estate, and driving Porsches around. And what's interesting about them is in their public lives, they've become everything their parents wanted them to be. They're complete establishment types. They're conformist. They work hard. They sell their soul to the corporation. But in their private life, they do things that their parents never, ever, ever would have countenanced. In their private life, they're still hippies. They demand complete freedom. They desire every bit of pleasure they can get without any moral restraint at all. In their public life, they give up all choices. And in their private life, they want every single choice there is, and they want anybody to tell them about it. And that's the reason why, to me, the perfect example of the modern man is Luke Skywalker. See, George Lucas did something really interesting in Star Wars. Here you have people who are into a pantheistic religion, right? The Force. But they all rely on high technology. So you're not either hippies or the establishment anymore. And so remember, on the way in, on Luke's last run-in, Obi-Wan Kenobi saying, follow your feelings, reach out with your feelings, Luke. Don't use the computer, the computer-guided weapon. Follow your feelings and use the Force, the pantheistic thing that holds all things together. But as John Naisbitt in Megatrend says, notice Luke Skywalker on his last run in to try to kill the Death Star, he does turn off his computer, but he doesn't turn off his engine. And there's a perfect example of a modern man who relies on technology and yet has gotten rid of the positivistic worldview. And it's not talking like that scientist was talking, about saying we've got to get rid of the positivistic world. We've got to start looking at psychokinesis and all these sorts of things because there's more out there than that. Now, that brings me to a summary of the waves. And the summary of the waves would be this. What we can expect to see happen in the next 20 to 40 years. Yeah, I know I got 10 minutes. I can tell you the future of this lecture. Oversimplification and so on. There'll be a technological spirit. Let's see. For those of you in the outline, that's the bottom of page 2 and 3. That is, there's going to be a growing intrusion of technology into all areas of life, and there's going to be a growing use of tech methodology to address all human problems. You see, for example, the only reason you can have an abortion industry, if you don't mind me bringing up a sore subject, I guess, the only reason you have an abortion industry is because you have bureaucracy and technology. For example, well, of course, technology made it possible, but bureaucracy is technology applied to human organization. So you're dealing with files instead of people. See, that's tissue. We're not strangling a baby. We're terminating a pregnancy. That's the language of bureaucracy. That's the attitude of it. Okay. Secondly, cultural pluralism. That means that we're going to see not a homogeneous culture, but a mass of culture. Every neighborhood is going to have its own culture, even have its own language, and it's going to stay like, you know, people are not going to be brought in and made to blend in anymore, but there's going to be a growth of a customized society. Third, radical individualism, which means growing distrust of and independence from experts and institutions. Growing entrepreneurship, there's going to be great distrust of experts and so on. Hunger for intimacy and experience. Because people are, and I haven't spent much time on this, because in the public sector, people are not allowed to bring personal values or religious values at all, there's a terrific hunger for experience and intimacy, and people are going to be turning to non-rationalistic, pantheistic spirituality to try to find some worldview that really accounts for everything. See, they're going to find that the technological society and technology does not account for everything. It can't account for love. It can't account for things. That's the reason why even science is starting to say maybe we need a different worldview. There's going to be a tremendous emphasis on leisure and image. You see, there'll be growing dominance of the media. Now, the media is technological, which means technology, by its definition, reduces everything to commodity, something that can be manipulated and shown. And therefore, it will be image that is important, not ideas. That's why in the selling of the president, you know, the what is the guy's name? Let's see. There was a quote, for example, Joe McGinnis in The Selling of the President quotes a memo from one of Nixon's speechwriters. We have to be very clear on this point that the response is to the image, not to the man. It's not the man that counts, it's what's projected. And in the media, that's true. For example, I just said midlife crisis. We didn't have midlife crises 20 years ago. We didn't have anorexia and bulimia either. Why is that a modern problem? Because of the emphasis on image. Well, girls look in the mirror and they're not skinny enough. They see themselves as being fat. The emphasis on image, not ideas. You don't have to argue somebody. You just have to make sure that they think what's happening is exciting or relevant or cool or up to date, not whether it's true, because we've lost that concept. And there'll be an emphasis on leisure industries. So personal pleasure, not work, is the meaning of life. Another trend is going to be globalization of politics and economics. Now, by that I mean that you're going to find fragmentation of political parties and nation states, and there's going to be a rise of a world economy, meaning, and it's the reason why America's having its problems right now, and that is because there's more interdependency between countries because of transnational corporations. There'll be a city-centric world. I mean, Harvey Kahn and Roger Green have been yelling this for years, and I have some of this material today, but I don't have time to go into it because you hear it anyway, and that is the world's becoming urbanized. Okay? It's becoming, modern technology is going to keep everybody from living downtown. So in a certain sense, you're not going to have, in America and Western Europe, you're not going to have the same concentration in the downtown because high tech makes it possible for you to live out in the suburbs and not have to commute in because you don't have to be in geographic proximity to your corporation. However, there'll still be you might say there's still movement into the metropolitan areas. And then lastly, family breakdown, which we talked about. Those are the trends, and I can simply orient you to what the trends are going to be bringing us to. For example, I put down here five rocks. Real briefly, let me tell you what they are. The first rock is four disasters which the optimists believe technology will solve, but you have to ask yourself. One of them is the problem of nuclear war. One of them is the problem of overpopulation. I know there's lots of arguments. Some people say we're overpopulated. Some people say it's a myth. I think everybody agrees that the world can't support more than 50 billion people. Everybody. And it's just a question of how fast we're going to get there. We're going to get there, but how fast? And so the people who are yelling that overpopulation is a myth, ultimately have to be backed in a corner and have to say, yeah, at a certain point, you know, you're obviously going to have too many people in the world. And so the fact is, when will that happen? The ecological problems, as you know, we're running out of it. You all knew that we're running out of oxygen, for example. I mean, everybody know that? I just think you ought to know that. 70% of all the oxygen comes from sea plants. And you all knew in ninth grade biology, you were taught that the reason we can breathe is because all those little green things out there are breathing oxygen out, so we can breathe it, right? Well, 70% of all of our oxygen in the world comes from sea plants, and 50% of the sea plants are dead already because the ocean is dying, and so we have all sorts of ecological problems that are coming, and I'm not going to go into that. And we have energy problems because we're running out of fossil fuels. In 20 years, we'll be out of fossil fuels, except for coal, which we have forever, but which creates tremendous problems of, you know, just not feasible to get it all out and get it around everybody. And nuclear industry is on its way down. So what are we going to do? Well, technology will come up with something. That's a question. That's one of the rocks. A second rock is social order and totalitarianism. The problem there is that, as you know, when there's no consensus in society, there's no sociological glue, then there is how do I put this? There's growing disorder. For example, in the 1960s, there was a blackout in New York City. Remember that? And you know what happened? There was a little bit of looting, but generally speaking, there was a lot of cooperation and helping one another and so on. 10 years later, in the very same city, and the very same time of the year, there was another blackout, and it was completely different. There was massive looting. There was all kinds of violence. And you have to say, in 10 years, how could that happen? And the answer is that when there's no glue in society, there's going to be dozens and dozens of little special interest groups just demanding their rights. That's all. And so instead of the rise of democracy, as most of you would know, the democracies are dying out. We've got how many left now in the world? About 12? And 140 totalitarian dictatorships, and that's the trend. Because you see, there's going to be a trend toward totalitarianism. It has to come, and technology makes totalitarianism possible. The transnational corporation is a real interesting prospect. For example, you know, George Orwell talked about massive countries coming together. So you had, Oceania, and what were the other ones? What were some of the other ones? In other words, massive nation alliances. But, you know, believe it or not, to me, one of the most interesting ideas of the future is in that B-minus, maybe a C-plus movie, Rollerball, with James Caan, in which they depicted the world of the future was run by several transnational corporations. And you had executives and vice presidents and boards that were in charge of the world. And that's much more likely in light of what we've been talking about here. The uncontrollable technocracy, technology is not in control. Nobody's in control of technology. Let me read you this one. This is perhaps the most scary thing of all. The most scary thing of all is that, you know, Jacques, I don't ever know if I'm supposed to try to pronounce this guy the way the French pronounce it or the way Americans pronounce it, but Jacques Ellul, which is what I say, and everybody else tells me, no, you, but I can't do it. He believes that technology is out of control of everybody. He says nobody's really in charge of it. And the reason nobody's in charge of it is because, he says, it's self-augmenting. And here's an example. This is an example. Robert Oppenheimer was an opponent of the H-bomb. He says, a bad idea. I don't think we ought to come up with nuclear, the H-bomb. Yeah. But when he saw, when he was finally shown the design for the H-bomb, he was overwhelmed. He said, it was so sweet and lovely and beautiful. When I saw that it could be done, I had to do it. And there was another scientist that Ozgenes quotes in that same chapter. He says, no one, not even the most brilliant scientist alive today, really knows where science is taking us. We are aboard a train which is gathering speed, racing down a track on which there are an unknown number of switches leading to unknown destinations, and no scientist is in the engine cab. And there may be demons at the switch. Most of society is in the caboose looking backwards. And the fact is, you see, in other words, when it's possible to do something, it will be done. The technological society, when it's possible to do something, it will be done, and no one will ask the consequences because they believe that if it's possible to be done, we will do it. That's the modern worldview we're talking about. A working worldview, a melding of existentialism in the private life and naturalism in the public life. One other rock, and I'm just going to finish the rocks and then just let you read the rest of the outline yourself. The new poverty, you may realize, as I said before, one of the worst problems we're coming to is technology is not creating a more just society. It's destroying the lower middle class. There will be, in other words, it used to be you could get out of college, get out of high school, and get a job in a factory and support a family. Now, it's impossible now, and it's going to be virtually completely impossible. New industry will either have high-paying jobs for professionals or broom-pushing jobs, that's all. So like down in Chester, Pennsylvania, which was decimated by all the industry leaving, the Chester City Council got together and opened up an industrial park, and in came new industry. Well, what's new industry? It's all high tech. So all the poor people living there go to you know, look for jobs, and every one of them's a minimum wage job. And so what you've got coming in the country is, and I could prove with statistics, is there's going to be a huge increase in poverty because, as you know, still only 15% of the people in this country have college degrees. Now, if you're surprised at that, it shows how ethnocentric you are, because you think, well, all my friends have college degrees, yeah. So I thought everybody was like that, which is not true. And so what you've got is we're going to become, there will be no middle class. There's going to be upper class and upper middle class, and there's going to be a lower class. And the differences between them are going to be very great, and there's going to be tremendous turmoil because of that. So what I want to show you on your outlines is the things that I've covered here in class are things that on the outline are not self-explanatory, right? Because they're not very detailed. But starting on page 4 is what I would consider to be things that Presbyterians are going to have to do to respond to every one of these things. It would be interesting to do a church planting, to talk about what kind of churches should we be planting in light of these things. I have a lot more detailed explanation, but I just wasn't able to get to it in 45 minutes. So we're just going to have to leave it at that. And let me close with prayer, please. Our Father, I thank you for the fact that in your word you tell us that you're Lord over the storm, that when your people see the flood and they see the hurricane, they see the trees bending under the wind, They give you glory. They cry glory to you because they know that you are enthroned over the flood. You're Lord of the storm. Now, Lord, as we've been looking at what the modern world is showing us and bringing to us, we see tremendous turbulence. We see waves crashing. We see tides colliding. We see worldviews colliding. And we see tremendous possibilities for problems, for crises, for confusion, for even cataclysmic disorder. And we thank you that we know that you're a sovereign God. And we as Presbyterians in particular can take rest and have peace in knowing that you really are in charge of the storm. We pray that we as Presbyterians would not simply look to the past, but also look to the future and ask ourselves how we can be your servants and obey you as our covenant Lord in the days to come. We pray that we would become better futurologists. Father, we thank you that your word actually helps us know what the ultimate future is going to bring. But Christians are extremely bad and historically poor at knowing what the immediate future is going to bring. We pray that you would change that and that we would be able to walk obediently, knowing not only you and knowing our own hearts, but also knowing the times and the seasons, so that we can preach with seasonable words. And we thank you for this time and this opportunity to think about not only our past, but our future. And we pray this in Jesus' name.